This is an Enterprise Time Security Podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Christian Baitkin, co-founder and CTO at Sumo Logic.
Hi there. It's good to talk to you. So I'm Christian, co-founder and the CTO here at Sumo Logic, the second day of our user conference. This is the third year we're doing this. I'm very happy we see all our customers here. A great buzz, lots of interesting conversations. These things are always ways for us to go out and be social for a couple of days before we go back writing code. Everybody enjoys it greatly, and we have a lot of the folks from the team here as well, so it's been a great 2 days.
It was an interesting keynote this morning. You dived into topics that most vendors don't touch with a bunch of terms that, looking around some of the people in the audience, I'm not sure they were quite sure what you were talking about at various points.
Like hiccups?
I thought the hiccuping seal was brilliant.
I'm running out of hiccup gifs. We had a cat last year.
One of the things you talked about was the fact that stuff happens, mistakes happen, things go wrong, but people really don't set their expectations well. So you talked about SLI, SLO, SLA. Can you give us a view as to how they come together?
We've been running Sumo Logic as a service for almost 10 years now. We build a product that the folks use to run their own services, troubleshoot, monitor. We have a good idea of sort of what troubleshooting looks like. A lot of it goes back all the way to the log files and search and so forth. But what I found over time is that definitions for what you should monitor and how you should monitor are actually not that clear cut. You can hear about golden signals and a lot of nerdy stuff, and you can go all the way down to tracking and using D-Trace to find out very, very, very interesting, actually, performance implications or that you can't really see. But in aggregate, by the time you're running a fleet of 10,000 instances in Amazon, you need to have some sort of higher-level abstraction on top of that. And so something that I found super interesting that's been making the rounds recently, and the terms themselves are not new, but I think they're being reframed under the banner of site reliability engineering. And a lot of this, at least the way that I've experienced it or that I've perceived it, it's coming out of the work that folks at Google have been doing. They've been writing these books on the topic of site reliability engineering, putting the spin on DevOps in general. What are we actually doing here as engineers from the perspective of not just writing software, but running these real-time live services 24/7? And a lot of the SREs, there's a lot of writings about cultural implications and the psychology of pager duties and escalations and all of this. And I think a lot of this is super interesting and very relevant to us and how we run the service. But from the perspective of just monitoring and the fact that we are providing a monitoring product, I was very closely looking at how they were describing their best monitoring practices. And this is where this terminology, this trifecta of SLI, SLO, and SLA comes into the picture that we talked a little bit this morning. I found that to be quite intuitive. We picked up on it increasingly so over the last couple of years at Sumo as well. And then as part of the keynote, we also showed a bunch of ways that we are tracking these things internally. But to come back to this, it's about, in my mind, the key part of the whole thing is the word objective. So the middle thing is the service level objective, where you're basically trying to make a commitment initially to yourself as to what you think a desirable level of service is. Then you construct SLIs that measure whatever it is that you want to measure, and we can talk about that a little bit more as well. And then you compare your 30-day window SLI or what have you against the desired SLO. Then you have a way to make actionable decisions off of that.
But this is the challenge, isn't it? Everybody talks about an SLA as if it was written in stone. It's what we've agreed with the customer. This is what we'll deliver. But as you said, they don't really know what it is that's against. They don't know what the objective is. How do people start to wind back what they think they're doing to create a valid objective from which they can then build everything else?
SLA is something that's almost entirely out of the technical realm, where we get into the remedies that customers can contractually demand and expect if certain SLOs as defined are not being met. Almost outside of the realm of monitoring, and it goes into lawyer land, and that's an interesting land itself. But on the service level objective, there's two ways to think about it, classic way of thinking about it. You either think about it bottoms up or top down. I actually started from the bottoms up perspective, thinking about, hey, we need to add the golden signals, buy the book Google stuff, error rates and request latencies and request counts on an API level, per microservice level, and then we're going to say, okay, it needs to be, we observe it, and it's probably going to be 99.0 initially, so let's hold ourselves to that. And let's ramp it up to, you know, 0.5, 0.9, 0.99, et cetera, and then you have lots of these SLOs and SLIs that support them in a very highly granular fashion, and you could potentially build huge pager duty automated alerting against the error budget hierarchies. That might all be well and fine, and you know, wake up your developers at night, probably in a better way than you would do it before, where you just alert on everything. From a customer's perspective, does it actually matter whether you monitor the individual microservice? And so our chief architect, Stefan, as I discussed this with him, said, no, you're looking at it the wrong way. It's really more important to do it top down and to basically work your way back from a customer centric view. And that's a thing that we shared in a keynote as well. We constructed four main customer centric SLIs. One is about basic ability to ingest logs, which is important in our system. And there's a number of facets to that. We broke out 5 sub-facets. You can actually register collectors because you have to register before you can send something. Then we receive it. We don't drop it. We index it within a latency goal and so forth. All of that rolls up into a top-level SLI. And the way that we constructed it then is we basically broke it down into 1 minutes. Basically, we measure it on a 1 minute basis. We use a 7 or 30 day moving window. We still haven't quite decided on that yet, but we generate the reports on both. And then if the top level SLI, that minute is considered to be bad, if any of the sub SLIs fail. For us, log ingestion can potentially be considered bad. If any of the 5 sub-SLIs can't register collectors, can't losing data and all these terrible things, that's a pretty harsh mistress there. But I think it makes sense because customers expect that kind of experience.
But how much of this has to be automated? If I look back over my time in IT, we've always done metrics in the data center. We've always looked at historically what we've done. We've gone backwards over time, particularly when we're looking to change a system or improve a system. One of the challenges moving from on-premises to cloud is all those old metrics that we used were no longer valid. You couldn't say, oh, well, we expect this level of growth or this level of service, because when we got into cloud, it was so easy to add new things to it that we lost control of that. How do you do this with that level of granularity and information that you're just talking about, where A, you pick the right things to monitor, B, we do it in a way that gives us value, not just raw data that confuses us.
And wakes up everybody all day.
Wakes up everybody all day.
Or night, actually, I should say. There's still a continuous opportunity there as well. What we found is that in order to go down, that Stefan, our chief architect that I mentioned, was suggesting, which really made a lot of sense, we ended up having to go back and instrument some of our code. Or actually use code to really generate some of those higher level measurements that go into the higher level SLIs. It wasn't just rolling up a bunch of CPU metrics. Then now, obviously, we have a great platform for doing that, and we combine those two approaches. That was actually work. To your point about, you have to think this through. This is no spray and braze. It's not a shotgun kind of thing. The shotgun part is easy. And then the people quit on you because they just can't sleep anymore. Mm-hmm. So what we're really trying to do there is go through it and apply, whether you want to think of it as limited or unlimited intellectual resources that we have, and try to really hold ourselves, agree on a view of the world.
One of the things I've heard regularly in the last 2 days is we're providing benchmarks for customers to compare themselves to other customers and where they are. People talking about making this simpler for customers, but metrics have never been simple. And one of the things I could not find earlier today when I looked around the website was mention of what makes good metrics. So if you're talking to a customer who's getting to this point and wants to start to do this, how do you get them to understand what makes a good metric as opposed to just yet another data point?
In many ways, that's something that we've been internally struggling with. That's, as an industry, we are incentivized to sell more data and just more data points to our users. But I do think that there's a huge opportunity to take our own learnings and evolve that into a methodology.
What interested me particularly was you started to talk earlier today about everybody having access to the data. One of the challenges I have with this is the more people have access to data, the easier it is to misunderstand what that data is actually telling them. But also, many of the people accessing the data don't have the tools or the knowledge or the understanding of how to interpret that data. So how do you widen data access, but at the same time make sure that widening doesn't become a bigger problem?
There's philosophy that we can overlay there. Not giving people access out of fear that they might abuse the knowledge that they can claim from it. Personally, I'm not sure I want to live in that world.
But there is a good case to be made that a little knowledge can be very dangerous if they don't understand what it does.
The basic thing that we have to ask ourselves is, what kind of trust do we put in humans? Do we fundamentally trust that a majority of people have agency, and that we actually trust that their basic input-output processing works in a way that's compatible with whatever construct of a society they are in is with. It's very obvious where this can potentially lead. Abuse of too much data, Cambridge Analytica, presidents and various other forms of officials have your own story over there in the UK. I don't know where to draw the line, but access to information is fundamental to driving intellectual achievement. That's kind of a philosophical thing.
But how do you make that information usable? Information and data points are simply that. They're like dots on a wall. What makes them usable to an artist is when you can join the dots and create a picture from them. In a data sense, that's context. The one thing that we suffer from with the volumes of data that we are gathering across an entire enterprise at the moment is context. If we're going to open up this data, we have to have context. Where do we get that context from? How do we apply that context?
in the context of the narrow problem of monitoring systems and securing them, there's a lot of metadata that's actually known at collection time. There's a lot of functionality that we have and that other products have to leverage that, and that's another key point that we were talking about. Now, in a wider sense, it starts with knowing what the context is. It starts with knowing what are the questions that you want to ask. There's no generic tool that can actually do that for you, I believe, but you're going on the right path. Data without an understanding of who created it, who measured it, who observed it, if you go down into theory of science, there is no such thing as objectivity. People get easily hung up in machines helping with objectivity. I think that's just total crap. And it's just not going to happen. They are all just means to an end. I'm firmly on the human augmentation side of the debate, actually, because it just seems to make more sense to me. And I know I'm not really answering your question here. The way that we define the access thing, it's obviously it's about being able to have, just very concretely, when our contracts don't have user limits and these types of things, you don't have to pay per user. So if you become a Sumo customer, everybody gets access to the tool. Then so that's just a basic thing. It's not necessarily true for everybody in the industry. So I like that. We can pull it off based on the way that we architected the system. So that's very basic. Of course, there is a role-based access control system on top of that, where the people who think that you shouldn't be seeing certain data for whatever regulatory reasons and so forth, you can't access it. The meta points are more important, where how can we construct a tool in such a way that people can go from question to answer in the fastest possible way? And how do we deal with that being a very open-ended question potentially? Lots of flexibility to potentially answer lots of different questions versus the convenience that comes with, or the lack of, or the potentially the missing convenience, because now you have to understand a query language. It's almost like you have to understand a little bit of command line foo. For some people, it's not a problem, but for others who've never seen a command line, it's a huge problem. And so we're continuing to work through these things.
But we're coming into a problem we're seeing elsewhere. If we think about general analytics in a business, we don't have enough data scientists to start put together the routines for users to want to do this. The net result is people are being told they've got to learn to code. If we look at the big banks, they're actually putting people through coding courses so that they don't have to have data scientists. These people can write their own code to run their own queries. In some environments, that's a reasonably viable option. In many environments, that's not going to be a viable option. What sort of tools do we need, and can we look at a community, the Sumo Logic community, and say, look, there's a whole bunch of you people out there who've solved these problems, who've looked for this type of data, who understand this. We're going to provide you with a place where you can share, sell, expose your tools for the greater good.
That's always been the master plan. These days we call it global intelligence. There's two facets to that. One is the fact that we have a big multi-tenant system, we can aggregate data. And there's a lot of stuff to talk about anonymization and so forth that we've gone through in processes and so forth. Certain data sets, and specifically we're doing this for a security data set that comes out of Amazon called GuardDuty. We actually have a critical mass of customers subscribed to that service, and we can actually aggregate that on a global level baseline, occurrences of certain types of security events and so forth. And that we can then give back to the individual orgs, and they can basically say, hey, here's how the frequency of potential attacks breaks down compared to the global baseline. We can take it one step further and automatically cluster our users based on either outside input, like we just know which industry they're in, we kind of do it that way, or we just use a bunch of machine learning, that those are somewhat better understood ways, or we cluster and compare with a peer set and so forth. We found that it's narrow, it solves a particular problem, it gives good signal for this particular data set. That makes, draw a very long arc here, but that is also part of universal access. We do make it easier for folks to make this particular data set more actionable.
If I look at a lot of the DevOpsSec conversation that's gone on in the last day and a half, it's been much more about removing friction, getting security more embedded, get rid of the culture problem. But this actually plays to security strength. This isn't about changing, becoming softer, nicer, friendlier people. This is about good old-fashioned security analytics. The challenge is selling both sides of this to that security team. How do you begin to convince them that actually we're supporting your existing tools? We're going to give you the data to make those tools work better. But at the same time, look, there's so many other places you can help instrument to make that more accurate.
It's a clear story. Part of what Sumo does is it is a security information and event management system, the so-called SIM. That's a category of product which was invented to bring together security events for many different point solutions. And security guys in particular are just notorious for going best of breed. So they need sort of Switzerland-type platforms where they can bring in all the data, do additional analysis, like ask all the meta questions, figure out whether they really have to act or whether it's just a pretty obvious for you. And it's just the amount of value that's being delivered through this, I think in our case, is very clear. Driving efficiency policy in the security operations center and so forth. That's the frontier that we're in. There's a lot of talk about using AI to make security more manageable, and I think everybody has by now realized that that is also a bunch of, how do you say this in British, horse shit? That's just hype, peak of inflated expectations. The reality is that security is still being done by actual people. There's the folks that hunt for threats, and they usually have a particular makeup, literally personality makeup, actually. Then there's the sort of more administrative folks that go through detected threads and you do incident handling. And then you have your compliance folks that can go all the way to risk, actually. And they all have very different personalities. But what we are seeing is that maybe not so much about compliance to some degree, maybe not risk quite yet, but between compliance and SOC people, there's sort of shift left movement that brings them closer to the point where the software is actually being developed to get their concerns taken care of. We do see that picking up. And I think today, as we are not developing software and throwing it over the wall anymore, and everything comes together, even within an enterprise, to sort of solve a business problem together, the silos are still there. In a good agile enterprise, which I think you need to be in order to survive the current sort of speed of innovation, you can't go into this battle of bastards like every day.
But a modern enterprise is no longer a single entity. These electronic systems that we're building today for digital transformation are deeply embedded with all of our customers. The signal information we get back is not just ours, it's what they're doing in our systems. As we start to build this new generation of system, as we start to use better orchestration, push out more microservices, have customers' microservices inside our systems and ours inside theirs, how do we start to close the supply chain security problem? Can we use this to close the supply chain security problem? Similarly, I'm looking in a lot of cases now for APIs. Why? Because security systems find it very hard to differentiate an API to API attack because it's a machine attack. Providing it looks like it's well-formed to the API, they'll let it go, but a lot of the variable data is being used to break the API open. In addition, most people don't know what the hell their API does or how it was created in the first place, so they're not a secure entity. For the supply chain attack, it's that coming in low but also using that automated. If we're going to have that massive explosion then of containers and objects and interchange between companies.
And IoT and having a very specific exploit against a particular chip that happens to be deployed in so many cameras and stuff like that. Suddenly you have a massive surveillance botnet or what have you, yeah.
So how do you from this start to then take SLOs and all the other things we've talked about and use those to be able to lock that down better?
I think it's all about incentivization. I don't even think it's a technical, this is fundamentally a human problem or sort of an economical problem and not a technology problem. I think technology can help and build systems to but usually these things go wrong in the design of the system and missing QE and missing even basic processes to figure out whether this firmware has been updated in the last 5 years or not, or whether the device supports auto update, or whether you can just roll up to it and plug in a cable and all of these types of things. And I think that's because these sort of consequences of missing this in the past have not really been felt by manufacturers and, you know, by companies. It's becoming a little bit more prominent right now, but you look at Equifax, there's a credit rate, they're still in business. They shouldn't be in business to begin with, and now they're still in business. The incentives are still not properly lined up.
If we look at that and we look at where we're going forward in the future, although this is a people problem, it's a continually repeatable problem. We haven't got rid of this problem in 20, 30 years. We've got a massive explosion in new technologies and the rate of them arriving in the enterprise is showing no sign of slowing down. In fact, we run the risk at the moment of having technologies come along that we never deploy because they're overtaken before they get to that deployment phase. And all of that comes down to that architecture that you mentioned just now. Where do we get the skills, the knowledge, and the ability to deliver the right architecture? Because at the moment, people are just fumbling around.
I don't have a perfect answer for that. It'd be interesting to hear your take on this. One of the things is just being conscious and having ways of doing things with very quick incremental feedback cycles to address these things. Don't over-design. Love it or hate it, but AWS is a huge enabler. We're running in AWS. When we saw Werner Vogel's talk in 2008, we were like, oh, wow. We as a bunch of lowly developers can now start building like entire SaaS services. How cool is that? They've had this sort of really radical innovation strategy of going out and just saying, okay, here's five guys and a PM, go build it. And they build stuff all the time. And a lot of it is successful and a lot of it is just not successful. And they just don't turn it off. Google, same thing, and it's probably a little bit Darwinian, but there's just the things that people value will probably survive. And I think the only way to get there is having some intuition and then just radical, agile, incremental improvement cycles and put it out there even if it's not perfect.
So you're standing in front of a group of customers who want to take on Sumo Logic. They've got a problem. They've started to go to containers. They've got Kubernetes running as their orchestration engine, but they don't know how they're going to secure this. Now, setting aside the cat videos and the hiccuping seals, what do they need to do?
It starts with, it's understanding one thing. Security, basically, in my mind, has two aspects. One is technology and the other one's process. So they need to understand what the processes are. And part of it is like just basic compliance and checklists and those types of things. And then they need to understand where are the technology hooks, you know, where you plug in something like a twist lock. Basic understanding that an image coming out of a Docker registry might contain the worst shit that possibly have, and making sure that they have the scanning in place and so forth. So there's point solutions that help with that. Then there's always the analytics problem. And that's, again, where we as the Meta platform come in and say, hey, point solutions are doing their thing. They're sensing things. They're providing access control and these types of things. But in the end, you need to have some amount of observability. Whether it's security or operations doesn't matter. You need to look at your audit trails. You need to look at your events and you do some basic correlation. That is the state of the art. We try to tweak the flexibility as well as consumability of these things. As a company ourselves, we don't necessarily prescribe how our customers are supposed to run Kubernetes. It's also very different in terms of you run it yourself versus you run it in Amazon versus Google. They have IAM is a different beast than whatever the equivalent is on the Google side. These kinds of access-based systems have very different entitlement and provisioning constructs. Those systems themselves are often huge vulnerabilities because they can become so complex with their policies and roles and so forth. You're putting all of these people, put all this cool stuff in there, and then you can't even compute who can access what. I don't think that we're telling people to do something necessarily radically new around that. It's just understand your technology, understand vectors of attack are, understand what's out there in terms of best of breed and state of the technology in terms of basic mitigations for this type of stuff. In our mind, you need a bit self-serving, but that's okay. You know, I'm a vendor. I stand by it. They have an analytics platform that can help with, you know, rules and alerting and being able to do forensics.
Refreshing to hear a vendor talk about it's an evolution of what we're doing rather than you've got to change everything. Christian, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Very interesting.